Welcome to Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast. I'm your host, Elizabeth Moran, Editorial Director of Fixed Income News Australia. Join me as I talk about the latest news, views and education in fixed income investment. I'll be joined by industry experts from Australia and across the globe. Welcome. Today I have Andrew Kenobi, who is Director and Portfolio Manager at Franklin Templeton, and we're going to be talking about yield and risk. Welcome, Andrew. How are you this morning?
Very well, Liz. Thank you very much for having me.
Our pleasure. Before we start, do you want to talk a little bit about the difference between yield and return? I think it's easy to get confused, and they're different. They're different terms, aren't they?
They are different terms, and they can easily be confused. So, I mean, certainly in fixed income, return is ultimately what you end up with between two holding periods, when you buy and when you sell. And that can be a function of yield as well as movement in price of the underlying security. Yield to maturity gives a pretty good, but effectively conveys the total return you will receive if you buy an instrument that's yielding, say, 5% and then hold it to maturity and, you know, reinvest that coupon at prevailing rates along the way. So I think the main issue there is yield is suggestive of what happens if you buy a security, then literally just put it in the bottom drawer until maturity, whereas total return can be quite different along that journey.
So in your role as portfolio manager, how do you identify good relative value investments?
Yeah, so there's two types of things we're trying to identify in our portfolios. One is literally physical bonds to buy and put in the portfolio. And so what we're really looking for there is issuers, be they government, corporate or securitised mortgage backed, that are very strong in terms of their underlying fundamentals. So in other words, we've got a high degree of confidence in the underlying cash flows that we're going to get, and we're certainly not expecting or concerned about default. And for those types of issuers, we're looking for bonds that we think are going to deliver very good return characteristics given their risk. And you know, we're fairly flexible in terms of how we go about that. So, for example, those securities could be in Australian dollars. They could be in another currency like US dollars, where we feel it's a better opportunity, but we then hedge that back to the local Aussie dollar currency. And the second thing we try to do is identify opportunities in the broader fixed income market, which is ultimately an interest rate market, where we see a dislocation or a difference between what we think the market is implying and what our investment process is suggesting in terms of the trajectory for an economy. And so when we look at things like interest rates, the outlook for interest rates, the shapes of yield curves, and even to a lesser degree, currency, we're thinking about, you know, is there an opportunity for us to position portfolios to take advantage of those markets?
Okay, so I know some portfolio managers have mandates or hurdles that they have to meet before they can invest. Do you have those sorts of, any sort of hurdles in your portfolios?
We have some very significant ones. So I think quality and liquidity are fairly high on the list. So quality, primarily what we're looking at is investment grade markets. So not necessarily excluding the very high end of low investment grade, but predominantly investment grade. So quality is very important. Then what we're looking for there is really, you know, underlying credit characteristics that are strong. And another aspect that I think is quite topical and important is liquidity. And so, you know, even if we think about that COVID period and 2020 in particular, where markets had a real liquidity shock back in March, April, we and others, I think, received a timely reminder that being able to liquefy your investments, particularly in bond portfolios, is very important, because investors at various stages will change their minds. They will seek to access capital from open-ended funds. And so, you know, we're always thinking about liquidity of underlying investments. And that really means that we will be excluding particularly things like loans or untraded securities from the funds that we manage.
Oh, that's quite interesting, because I know loans are quite a popular investment, growing in popularity, and but that they don't have certainty as bonds do. There are so many thousands and thousands of fixed income securities out there. How do you sort of further narrow your search once you've said quality, obviously, and return given risk? How do you then narrow it further?
Sure. So basically across our team, we have a group of analysts whose job it is to research issuers within their sectors or the regions that they're focusing on, and then produce a recommended list of issuers that they're comfortable portfolio managers owning. And that becomes what we call our buy list. So, you know, the universe is literally hundreds and hundreds of borrowers globally. So if we exclude high-grade governments where, you know, we're generally comfortable owning those sovereign names, and look at corporates, we distill that down to a sort of focus list of maybe 100, 150, 200 names that we're generally happy to have in portfolios. They could be in Aussie dollars, or they could be in other currencies like US dollars or euros. But we then take that list and consider, well, what can we look to access in the domestic Aussie dollar market, and other opportunities to augment that with select positions in other currencies. So, yeah, we have a systematic process to get that down. We would prefer to own a large number of holdings than a more concentrated portfolio. It'd be very unusual for us to have more than 1%, for example, in any particular issuer.
So just talking about the number of issuers and identifying issuers, obviously issuers issue in multiple markets. Are you looking for differences in yield between markets as well as just the issuer in Aussie dollars, say, for example?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, for example, we own Westpac Tier 2 bonds in US dollars at the moment. And certainly buying those securities, hedging it back to Aussie dollars, is giving us a better return than we could get if we just bought the equivalent bonds that are available in Aussie dollars. So for us, it's always about what gives the better return for our investors rather than what's purely available just in the Australian dollar market. The bond market is a global market, and so issuers themselves, be they banks or corporates, are always looking at which markets to issue securities in, and that's a function of where they see the best funding costs as well as some other considerations. And similarly for us as an investor, we're always considering where can we get the best return for our clients, taking a little bit more of a currency agnostic perspective. And so, yeah, we will look at those opportunities all the time.
That's really interesting. And when you're looking, do you actually have a target yield in mind, given the current interest rates, or it's just a risk and yield equation with that list of issuers?
Sure. So basically, we're seeking to look for issuers that offer a very good expected total return relative to the risk of that issuer. So that's obviously going to be a higher yielding security or a higher spread for a lower rated or riskier corporate, say a BBB, than it would be for a single or AA. And so for us, it's about, you know, is something offering very good potential return given its risk profile? At the total portfolio level, we're certainly looking for the portfolio to deliver an attractive return over and above the benchmark. And so really, we want to sort of have a very diversified portfolio that's also got a strong quality anchor. So we're not going to certainly just try and focus on getting the highest yielding securities always into the portfolio, because naturally we'll end up with a riskier portfolio, which, you know, optically might look like it's going to return high return over time, and it may well do, but it may also bring with it a lot of volatility and other unwanted characteristics.
Talking about benchmarks, Andrew, do you follow benchmarks, or
yeah.
And how does the group decide on which benchmark to use for a new fund?
Yeah, so most of the funds we manage are effectively against cash or bank bills, or what you consider as a short duration money market type benchmark. And the reason for us having that as our benchmark is we think that's what most investors begin with. They sort of start with cash, and then they decide to do something else. And so that something else starts with bonds or fixed income, then it may go into other asset classes. But generally, fixed income is very, very much linked to cash returns. And so, you know, we think that's a very good way for us to be thinking about how we allocate risk in portfolios. We're very cognizant of traditional bond benchmarks in terms of the characteristics they have in terms of duration, sector, et cetera. Because we want to be aware of what the trends are in the market. We want to be aware of you know, what other traditional bond funds are doing. But for us, cash is the most important benchmark, and that's the one we aim to outperform.
I'd never thought of it that way, so I'm really pleased that you've said cash is a starting point, because it is for so many investors. You know, if they're uncertain, they put their funds into bank deposits. So I know there's a lot of risks out there, and I look at PDSs and there's three pages of risks. And at the moment, geopolitical risk is quite high on everyone's agenda. But perhaps what do you consider the key risks in under any economic conditions or scenario?
Yeah, it's a very difficult one. So I think if we leave aside sort of traditional macroeconomic risks, you know, do we get another resurgence in inflation, for example, and think about other things? Certainly geopolitical risks are always on the radar and always you know, something to consider, but equally quite hard to predict. And so, you know, we're now entering the third year of the war between Russia and Ukraine, for example. That's, I think, been a surprise to many that it's gone on this long, and certainly not necessarily going the way some had considered. That's a concern. The longer conflicts generally go on, the higher the risk that they morph into something else. And of course, we have other trouble spots, the Middle East being one, but I think also in our own backyard, you know, there are some tensions emerging in Asia Pacific. How to think about those from an investment perspective is quite difficult, other than to be aware that they're going on and consider the probabilities, I suppose, as best one can. Look, the other things I think that are worth highlighting is certainly this side of the pandemic, you know, some other structural themes that are going on in terms of how supply chains are organised around the world, whether economies and companies are trying to you know, shift the way they access production, and also, you know, we would point to just this whole energy transition story, which is obviously a multi-year process, and what that means for economies and energy security as well. So it's sort of thinking about all these things, but they're quite slow moving and difficult to forecast.
So true. How do you feel about, or how do you approach ESG, environmental, social and governance issues?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about this, and you know, I've been doing this for quite a long time, is I kind of feel in some ways ESG has always been you know, embedded in good processes. So I think in recent years it's become far more highlighted as a separate component of investment processes. But I think good investors have always thought about the way issuers, corporates are managing their stakeholder relationships. Governance is obviously one that's critical, but I think equally the way that corporates engage with you know, their environmental footprint and responsibility, and the way they treat people, be it their own employees or stakeholders that they come into contact with as well. So, you know, for us, we're looking for substance over form. And really what I mean there is we're much more interested in issuers that are exhibiting, you know, strong outcomes over time than proclaiming, you know, a certain stance, or, you know, a very nice presentation that they can show up and exhibit. And so that just really means getting to know an issuer, getting to actually see how they run their business, you know, their values and what drives them. And, you know, we would look for ESG to, you know, affect the whole organisation. We're much more interested in issuers that, you know, showing a very strong outcome across the board than sort of turning up and saying, hey, we want to issue a green bond. You know, give us credit for that.
Now, globally, banks are big issuers and they issue at lots of different levels in the capital structure. And there's often relationships between the levels, particularly with Australian top four banks. Can you talk a little bit perhaps about those relationships and how you might identify opportunities or...
Yeah, sure. No, look, absolutely. So, I mean, generally speaking, for the bank issuers, there's three types of instruments they'll issue in the capital market. So in the term market, that is. So the senior unsecured is the largest, most liquid, highest quality, and that's where they're basically issuing at the top end of the capital structure, and they have creditor preference, if you like. And then they'll issue various types of capital instrument to help support their total capital requirements. So the higher quality component of that is what we call tier two capital. And banks are large issuers of tier two securities, both in Australian dollars and US dollars. And typically, historically, tier two will trade at a spread premium to senior, given that it is subordinated and it is slightly higher risk. And that spread multiple is normally, say, 2 to 2.5 times the spread of a senior unsecured bond. So if a senior unsecured bond is pricing with a spread of 100, a tier two security should price with a spread of 2 to 250, for example. Generally, over time, we look at tier two, if it's trading below 2 times, is on the more expensive end of the spectrum. And if it's above 2.5 times, it's getting more interesting. And of course, the banks will issue those tier two and senior instruments again in multiple currencies, and that creates opportunities. And then the third type of instrument that banks will typically issue in the capital markets is tier one. And that's more subordinated again to tier two, and that's higher risk again. And that's really getting closer to traditional equity in terms of risk, but still above. Aussie dollar tier one instruments typically take the form of what we see as hybrids. So the four majors will issue hybrid bonds, and they are very focused on the retail market. They are not an institutional product typically. And the consequence of that is we do see them as trading reasonably expensive relative to global tier one securities. And so I think, again, the tier one market in Australia is much more of a retail market and less of an institutional market as it is offshore.
There have been instances, haven't there, where the margin on the tier ones is less than the margin on the lower risk tier twos?
There have been instances. I mean, Westpac issued a domestic tier one back in the end of last year at about 310 basis points over the benchmark swap rate. Which certainly gives you a yield in the sevens. But again, you know, global tier one securities would be high single digits, if not double digits, in the current environment. That 310 that Westpac issued in compared with another global institution that we think is quite strong, in this case Lloyds Bank, which issued a tier two security in Aussie dollars at only slightly less than that 310 basis points. So again, I think it was an example of where the domestic market, you know, has some distortions, if you will, just because of the nature of the investor base.
I think there's been a little bit of a rush to those securities as there's been discussion over whether they'll continue to be offered to retail investors. So maybe that's part of why those spreads have come right in. But they have been very popular for a long time. How much do credit ratings factor into your decisions, and do you use them?
Certainly use them. I mean, we certainly look at the ratings opinions of the major agencies, Standard & Poor's, Moody's and Fitch. But our job is to really make up our own mind in terms of what we think the underlying credit health of issuers is. And we won't necessarily replicate the process of the rating agencies, but we won't sort of take as gospel truth their own conclusion, and we'll form our own view on each individual issuer that we're looking at. So certainly important. But we don't sort of rely on them entirely.
And how does yield and risk differ between like a bonds, corporate bonds, and securitized investments that are still part of the fixed income asset class?
Yeah. This is a great example of how markets will tend to price different risks, even for the same rating. And so, theoretically, in rating agency kind of parlance, or in terms of conceptual thinking, a single A is a single A and a triple B is a triple B, et cetera, regardless of whether it's a corporate bond or a securitized bond or a government bond. But capital markets have a way of tending to price other risks differently. So, for example, the Australian mortgage-backed securities market, which is, you know, actually now quite a large market, quite high quality, overwhelmingly triple A in terms of its composition. Spreads on those securities, in our opinion, are actually quite attractive. And in some cases, we've seen issues from triple B corporates, certainly low single A corporates, that have offered around the same spread, if not sometimes less. So there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that mortgage-backed securities are still structured securities. So there's a little bit of a premium that investors will receive just for the fact that there's some structuring that goes on and, you know, that carries a bit of complexity, et cetera. And secondly, we do see in the Australian dollar market what I would consider to be a little bit of a home bias towards certain names. So certainly when you see issuers that have that sort of household familiarity, a couple of examples being like the major supermarkets or Telstra, they tend to come at what we would consider quite tight spreads because they've been around a long time, they're sort of blue chip names, they're quite favoured. We don't get a huge amount of issuance from corporate issuers outside of banks, and therefore there's a bit of supply-demand mismatch. And, of course, there's a lot of investors who can only or will only buy Australian dollars. And so, you know, these issuers can price quite tight in terms of spread relative to other names. And I think mortgage-backed securities is a good example.
Just a couple of other questions. Do you have a credit committee?
We don't actually have a credit committee. What we have is a team of analysts globally. It's about 34. Two of them sit here in Australia in our team. Others sit across Asia, Europe, the Americas, et cetera. And the job of that team is to basically cover a list of names in certain sectors or regions and form their own views on those names and then create recommendations for investment teams and portfolio managers. And that's basically, you know, are you happy to buy or hold those securities? Or are you, you know, actually quite negative on a name? And so that forms the foundational recommendation for can portfolio managers buy a security or not, rather than a committee. We'll certainly sit around in teams of investors, portfolio managers, and decide how we want to build portfolios, but we're not sort of going to make the individual decision on a credit at that level.
It's really interesting. I'm really enjoying this discussion. But just coming to an end now, is there anything you'd like to add or anything you think we might have missed in our discussion on yield and risk?
Well, I think the only thing to add, Liz, is, you know, we're now in the start of 2024, well into 2024, you would say, and this is again arguably another year of the bonds, even after 2023 was, I think, for some people a disappointment. We've seen a lot of money go into bonds, particularly traditional government bonds, looking for that traditional post-rate hike kind of wave where we start to see cuts and big returns. And I think the only thing I would say is, you know, the environment is a little bit more nuanced than that. So I think the opportunities in the asset class are very good, but it's not necessarily going to be a linear path higher in price. I don't think we're going to see rates go back to 1%, for example, absent an accident. And therefore, I think, you know, the case to build portfolios focused on yield, but with some traditional characteristics and defensiveness is pretty strong.
Andrew Kenobi from Franklin Templeton, thank you so much for joining us today. Our listeners will be thanking you as well for your very frank comments and insights into yield versus risk. And I hope you'll join us at another time.
Thanks very much, Liz. Appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us this week on Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast. Still hungry for more fixed income news, views and education? Then visit fixedincomenews.com.au and don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter to have the latest news delivered right to your inbox. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Elizabeth Moran and we'll see you next episode on Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast.